From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is a Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. As we gather again with loved ones, this hour we bring you conversations about coming together and reunions.
The communal breaking of bread and just laughing and having a good time over food, because that is one thing that unites us. We all eat.
We hear from author Richard Russo and the Boston Globe's Billy Baker on getting together with friends.
I wanted to know how to be friends with my friends in this period in life we call middle age, where there's so many other things begging for your attention.
Plus, the story of the painful and joyful reunion between former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson and his birth mother, Rachel.
My family told me that he was dead, so everything was in Tito's hands. So if he didn't find me, I'd still be in the wilderness about this.
That's all next on a Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us this Memorial Day. It's a day set aside to honor and remember the members of the military who have died in service to our nation. And that's the case this year as people across the Commonwealth pause and reflect. This year, Memorial Day is also a return, in a sense. The more than 37,000 little American flags are back on Boston Common for the holiday. The pandemic, at least, seems to be easing. This weekend is the first weekend where folks in the Commonwealth can return to doing things they used to do, getting together with family and friends without masks, dining, shopping, seeing shows. In the past couple of weeks, we have been reflecting on what we hope is coming back. Here's Cheryl Strotter, chef and owner at Soleil in Nubian Square, telling us what she's been missing at her restaurant and what she hopes fully returns.
The vibe that I miss the most is people coming in, whether it's a business meeting or a family or friends event, and they're just laughing and joking and talking about life and talking about their day. I miss the communal breaking of bread and just laughing and having a good time over food, because that is one thing that unites us. We all eat different types of cuisine, and I miss the joy and the happiness that people have when they're dining.
Or these sentiments from two of our own on Radio Boston, Chris Siderick and then Jamie Bologna, reflecting on parenting in the pandemic and how their respective kids emerge.
As I've seen our kids start to slowly do things in the very recent past year, is that right now they're still in this state of where being in public has this kind of element of anxiety to it. So much of what we've done as parents through the years has been trying to make the world seem as this big, fun place full of adventure and things to be curious and things to learn about. And I hope that we can get back to that perspective as quickly as possible.
I just hope that our son gets the opportunity, and I think this will happen soon, to make some friends who aren't family. But it's also a reminder to me just how important this time has been to spend with family.
This hour, on a Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston, we revisit conversations about coming together, reunions, and reflecting on the past. And we'll start with author Billy Baker, because even before the pandemic, the Boston Globe writer found it almost impossible to stay connected. At 40, his editor assigned him to, quote, write about how middle-aged men have no friends, end quote, after some pretty funny soul-searching about why his editor assigned him that story. He took a journey to find out why this happens and to reconnect with his own buddies. His message about the importance of friendship struck us as particularly personal during a pandemic when no one could hang out. We spoke with him earlier this year when his memoir, We Need to Hang Out, first hit booksellers. And we began with that fateful assignment from his editor and the journey it set him on.
Well, first, I'd try to talk myself out of it, you know, to try to justify why I wasn't perfect for it. And the more I thought about it, I was all too perfect for it. And mostly because I had a typical story. You know, I thought I was checking off all the important boxes with job and family and kids and what are we having for dinner? But, you know, each day I wasn't really doing anything for my friendships.
Obviously, the pandemic has made it harder. But you really lay out that this friendship crisis or crisis in friendship wasn't just for you and really was unfolding for people sort of in the middle of life long before COVID-19. What did you learn?
It's getting progressively worse. I mean, in terms of the way we measure it. And I would have never thought I was part of the problem. I mean, Vivek Murthy, who was the Surgeon General at the time I went on this little journey or began this journey, this was his chief platform. He was going around everywhere spouting about how loneliness kills, how dangerous this was, how it can affect not just our mental health, but our physical health. And I'm not sure I would have been ready to handle it or to listen to it or to raise my hand and acknowledge it might be a part of it. But I got conned into this assignment by an editor and I took it on and I realized I was indeed perfect for it. The data is there. We're getting worse. It's terrible. I mean, the health consequences are almost unbelievably bad. I still find it hard to believe this idea that if you don't want to see the doctor, see your friends. But The question then became like, all right, we've identified the cancer, like what's the cure and how do we go about doing it? And anyone that's tried to make friends or, you know, try to reach out to Ulfa, it's a weirdly awkward process that really means you have to be vulnerable. And especially for men, that's just not something we're programmed to feel comfortable doing.
We've got Ian on the line from Dorchester. Ian, you're on with Billy Baker.
I just wanted to ask about whether or not you go into detail in regards to men of the older generation's inability to process their emotions properly. So a lot of older folks that I know, they tend to just kind of react aggressively or mad when things happen and go wrong. And so in friendships, you know, that can be pretty tumultuous, I think.
Thanks for the call, Ian. Billy.
Yeah, I don't think it's exclusive to older guys. Each person's an individual, but you know, I do talk quite a bit about sort of all the aspects of friendship in the book. One of them is fight or flight, which is something that is how men react to stress. And we either take off or we can be, a jerk ready to throw hands. And there's a fundamental difference where when stress comes for women, they do something that is known as tend and befriend. So there's a lot to learn from how women react to stress as opposed to men.
You know, you touch in the book on masculinity in friendship, femininity in friendship, but you spend a lot of time on a word you used a couple of minutes ago, which is vulnerability. And we've put for you a passage for you to read about a grand gesture of going to an airport to save a relationship that I think speaks to that vulnerability a little. Would you read it for us?
Sure. If I'm honest, I must admit that I'm a sucker for those scenes in movies where the guy races off to the airport to save a relationship. They're all the same, but damn if they don't all work. There's the frantic cab ride, the throwing of the money at the driver, the dash into the terminal searching for the departures board, the scanning of the flight numbers, the zoom in on the words final boarding, and then the run. I love the run. The tracking shot, the swelling music, the complete disregard for the fact that you haven't been able to do any of these things in an airport since 9/11. The hero bobbing and weaving his way through the crowds, hurtling children in wheelie bags. Cut to the gate agent who is announcing the final boarding call. The hero is full on sprinting now as more children in wheelie bags appear in his path. Now the woman is at the jetway, taking one last forlorn look over her shoulder, pondering, before hesitantly handing over her ticket. And wait! And now I was ready to do all of this for a buddy.
Exactly. A buddy who had moved to Vienna. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So I wrote this article for The Globe about how guys stunk a friendship. And in it, I mentioned my two best friends from high school. And as soon as the article came out, I emailed it to them. And one of them replied and said, I totally agree with everything you're saying, which is why what I'm about to tell you is not going to go over well. But I neglected to mention that I moved to Vienna in Austria.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah, it happens, right? Like it shouldn't have, but we'd lost contact just enough where before leaving town, I just wasn't on the list of things to do and we were both to blame. And so to try and save it, I did this, what's ultimately a romantic gesture to chase him to the other side of the world to try and save something that was important to both of us and to acknowledge it was important to both of us.
And tell our listeners, did you save it?
I did, yeah. To some extent, he's now missing again, but we reconnected. Now he's living in an Airstream trailer somewhere near the Grand Canyon. So we're not hanging out on a daily basis, but I think our friendship is stronger than ever.
Besides, it sounds like maybe part of him just likes to go missing a little, and you can't really take responsibility for that.
That's a thing, yes. That's we call that pulling a Rory, and he's very good at it.
We've got Natalie on the line in Revere. Natalie, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to say, I can't speak to the male aspect of this, but me and my friends, two of whom are male, but they're our gay best friends since high school, and we've all been friends for the last 22 years. We keep on a group text that we all check in with pretty much multiple times weekly. We haven't been able to see each other, obviously, through this crazy times as much as we'd like to, but we've had a couple of friendly COVID meetups. And if I didn't have them, I wouldn't have gotten through the tough times in my life. And, you know, what's most important to me is my relationships with them. And I just hope people can still find a way to connect and share the things with the people that they love.
Thanks, Natalie. Billy, let me let you react to that.
I mean, isn't it the best thing in the world? Like, this is a conversation. It's two conversations, right? We talk about loneliness, and that word just kind of clears the room, right? It's something we're not super comfortable talking about. And so I started with an assignment in loneliness, but then I went on a journey in friendship. And isn't that like one of the happiest, warmest words we have? And to just listen to her talk about this crew of friends that means so much. These are the important things in life. And I, if I was guilty of anything, it was not prioritizing that. It was ranking it as something I did after the important stuff was done. And that stuff is never done.
You know, Natalie just now talked about the fact that she checks in with her friends weekly, and that made me think of Wednesday nights in the book. Can you talk a little bit about Wednesday nights?
So Wednesday night was an idea I stole from a man I'd met, an older guy in the town I live in. I live on the North Shore in Essex, and he had mentioned one day that he had this crew that got together on Wednesday nights. They've been doing it for decades, and it sounded sort of cute. And then when I started on this journey, it was like, I think that's what I need, ultimately. What's chronicled in this book is this kind of comic adventure, and much of the beginning of the book is me going through the relationships of my past. And ultimately, what I realized is that if I really wanted to get the benefits of friendship, I needed it to be part of my daily life. So I basically set out to build a new squad in the present. And so I took this Wednesday night idea. I found a guy who was willing to let us use his barn on Wednesday nights. And then I invited a dozen guys and said, basically, do you want to join my middle-aged dad fraternity where we hang out on Wednesday nights? And I don't know what we're going to do, but it has worked. And we are talking on a Thursday. And I spent Wednesday night, last night, around a campfire with 10 guys who it was sort of a pseudo book launch party for them. But they spent basically 2 hours making fun of me. And it was great.
10. And this, it's been a couple years now that you've been doing Wednesday nights.
It's been about 2 years. And, you know, I mean, we don't get 10 every time, but it, you know, right now with COVID, these grand questions of like, how do we connect? We've been gathering around the fire, which is so primal and simple. And yet I can't tell you what we do. I can tell you that we haven't forgotten how to be juveniles. You know, I mean, we're all 40-something guys who are wondering how high we can make the fire before someone calls 911 on us. You know, it's so simple. It's such a simple pleasure. And it's not like we get to deep topics all the time. But if we need to get deep, or you really need someone, you know, to have your back, like, I feel like I now have them. And that was something that was missing from my life before all of this.
You talk a lot. There are several vignettes in this book about the moments where you had to choose to be vulnerable and say to someone else, basically, will you be my friend or will you still be my friend?
Oh, so awkward. Is it? I mean, just hearing you say that, I can feel the, yeah. And you know what? Every time it worked, you know, being a little bit vulnerable, showing intent, reaching out, like, I mean, I'm not the only person who needs someone to hang out with on a Wednesday night. It was easier than I thought it was going to be in my head. That doesn't mean there weren't some dumpster fire ideas that I threw at the wall and didn't stick. But, you know, I tried, people responded, and ultimately, you know, I don't know, my friends from the past, I'm more actively friends with them, and I have new friends in the present. It's been, would I have done any of this had I not been forced by an assignment or the idea that I was going to write a book? Like, I'm not sure, but I'm thankful that I did.
What can people do now to keep those friendships alive and to keep from being lonely and keep nurturing those relationships?
I mean, it's the same things pre-pandemic, and it's sometimes the simplest things. Like, it took me a while to figure out what it was and what I was trying to say, but I came up with this term I call velvet hooks. And you just need to find that thing that's soft. It's not like overly committal, but we know what they are, right? Like, they're the book clubs and the fantasy football leagues and the bowling nights and the, you know, whatever it might be. They've been going on forever. COVID has obviously put a damper on some of those, but they're still out there. They're still available. I mean, I have a Wednesday night crew that we sit around a campfire. You know, there's that monthly walk you might take, whatever it might be. Obviously, outdoors is a safer way to do this. But I think, you know, when this first started, there were all these Zoom reunions, and I think we might be a little bit burnt out on another Zoom invitation at this point. It just takes, you know, finding a way to be friends with your friends, you know, finding whatever that velvet hook is for you, for a group, for each individual, and then, you know, sticking with it. Experts will tell you that the best thing is something that's regularly on the calendar, because then life works around it. If you try to schedule every time, it gets tricky.
Author Billy Baker speaking with us back in January when his memoir, We Need to Hang Out, came out. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. Welcome back to this Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this hour we are pausing to reflect on this past year. And since this is the first weekend of the state's full pandemic reopening, we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations about reflection and reunions. Our next conversation is with New Englander Richard Russo, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, author of 9 novels, and a friend of the show. He joined us in studio back in the fall of 2019, right before we descended into our pandemic reality. He came to WBUR to tell us about his most recent novel, Chances Are. It follows the story of 3 lifelong friends, Teddy, Mickey, and Lincoln, who met in the 1960s at a small liberal arts college. Now they're in their 60s, and we get a strong sense of nostalgia from them as they head back to Martha's Vineyard for a reunion. And with a reunion like this, and indeed throughout the book, Russo interlaces this idea of nostalgia for a time gone by. And that's where we picked it up when he visited Studio 3 in 2019, and the nostalgia he personally feels for his past.
I think most people, probably around age 50, thereabouts is when it began to happen to me, find themselves looking forward still because we have children, we have grandchildren, the future is going to be important to them. And yet, gosh, we find ourselves looking backwards a lot too. My last 3 books actually have been about me trying to make sense of this life that I've lived, which in many respects seems improbable. I'm trying to explain it to myself in those other 2 books and now and in this one.
So you say your last 3 books have been about you. There are 3 characters, 3
right.
male characters
right.
who are the leads in this book. So where are you?
Oh, I'm all over the place, Tiziana. just try to find a page that I'm not front and center in. No, I mean, in this book with these 3 characters, I'm kind of assuming the wisdom of what Walt Whitman said when he said, "I'm large, I contain multitudes." I think what I've done in this book is to take these 3 friends and kind of divided my own personality. Well, I was going to say right down the middle, but of course,
yeah,
it would
be
to divide them in 3. Lincoln kind of represents every time in my life when I have ever played it safe, and often because I've had to. What these 3 friends have in common, of course, is that they do not come from wealth. They're all living their lives essentially without a safety net. If they mess up, it's on them. And Lincoln is the kind of guy who feels that pressure a lot. And it has caused him, over the course of his lifetime, to play it safe probably more than he should. And he's come to now that age. They're all 67 when this book begins. And he's come to now wonder what his life would have been like if he'd taken a few more chances. Teddy is, I think, represents more of the kind of spiritual aspect of my own existence. My readers, I don't think, are going to be terribly surprised to learn that I was an altar boy right straight through high school.
Not a shock.
No, not a shock. And Teddy, even as he has fallen in love with the same beautiful girl that his two friends have, he has no trouble any more than I did at 14 or 15 imagining himself as both a ladies' man and perhaps a holy man.
Yeah, kind of celibate, but also Lothario.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Those are not contradictions to his mind, at least not at age 15. And he is seriously, at least as seriously as you can at that age, contemplating a kind of monastic life. Mickey, the third friend, is that part of my personality that when I have my doubts about how I've lived my life, when I think, okay, I've written these books and I love having done it, but have I really lived the right life? That's usually when there's a great song on the radio. And at that point, all I want to do is what Mickey does, is strap on a Fender Stratocaster guitar, plug it into a killer amp, and play rock and roll music at a very high volume.
It's funny, as I read him, I realized that I had nicknamed him in my head the human motorcycle.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up with Harley people. And
did you?
Yeah. And
I wouldn't have guessed that.
There's something about Mickey. He's like a human motorcycle. Yeah. You know, he's out on the open road.
Yeah.
Doing his thing.
Yeah. And without a helmet.
Yeah.
Too.
Which comes up, I think.
Yeah.
In the...
yeah.
All right. So one of the themes we think that you're exploring in this book is this sense of free will versus destiny.
Right.
There is really an idea that there is can be a moment or a choice that either fixes you kind of in place or changes your path. Are we right? We were talking about this and getting ready for this interview. And B, did that happen to you at some moment? Is there a moment that you are where you are now because of that choice you made then?
Oh, wow. There are those choices that you make for yourself. You say, I could do A or B, and you choose A. And then you wonder what would have happened if you'd chosen B. And then there are sometimes other things that are involved. Choices get made for you, especially when you're young. And the real crossroads in my life was when I was 17/18. And I was living in a small upstate New York mill town. My parents had split up, so I was living with my mother. And my mother had grown up in that same town. And she was now in her late 40s and felt completely trapped in her life there. We lived upstairs over my grandparents. And she was just desperate to go somewhere else. And she decided that she wanted to move to Arizona. The problem was she had no way to get there. She didn't drive herself. So she used me to drive the getaway car. In a sense, she allowed me to buy a car, which so surprised me. And she started leaving little clues around the house about where I should go to college. Maybe the University of Arizona would be nice, she said. And I just followed those little crumbs around the house and ate them until when I was 18, only had my driver's license for just a few months. We hitched a U-Haul trailer to the back of our underpowered car, and we drove like a couple of fools. We drove all the way across the United States in a car that we had to choose. We actually had to choose where we would stay. We had to choose our motels according to how steep the exit ramp was.
And I want you to know, as I'm listening to you, there is road trip music playing in my head as I'm listening to you.
Yeah. So, I mean, we did that. We should have died. We should have died on the road. I didn't know how to do that. I wouldn't have known how to do it even if I wasn't towing a trailer. But I didn't know how to do that. And somehow we made it. And I learned when we got there that my mother didn't have the job at General Electric she said she had. She didn't know how to drive, but she had to learn, after which the car was hers. I went down to the University of Arizona. It's the single most foolish thing I can ever think of two reasonably smart people doing. And every single good thing in my life has come from that. I went to Arizona. I met my wife of 48 years there, who gave us our two wonderful daughters and now grandchildren. I became a man there. I became a writer there. All as a result of foolishness.
also of your mother. I mean, also of this woman. And it, so that is very interesting. So JC is the female main character.
Yeah.
And I both loved her and felt like she was a device, not a person in the story. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you about that. Was she the alter ego of all the mothers who were so contained and restrained in the story as well?
That's true. All three of the mothers in this story have taken a back seat in some way to the men who they're married to. And they haven't had an awful lot of choice. And part of it was the time. But I think more than that, JC is kind of an unknown because this is a story that's not about what men know about women. It's a story about what they don't know. And one of the things that they don't know when all three of these young men fall in love with JC, they think they're falling in love with her because she's smart and she's beautiful and she's sexy and she's an embodiment of the times, of freedom. What they don't understand that she is also an embodiment of things that they have been chasing without even knowing that they're chasing it. It's not just freedom. It's also JC's whole world. She comes from a world of wealth and privilege and piano lessons and all the things that rich kids grow up with that poor kids don't. And when you fall, and when you're Mickey or Teddy or Lincoln, and you fall in love with a girl like JC, you don't realize that it's more than her that you're falling in love with. So in a way, JC can't be as fully developed as the other characters, because as soon as she does, then the book is about her and not what she represents,
right,
to
not
lower
the
class
idea
kids.
Of
yeah.
JC.
Yeah.
Pulitzer Prize winning author Richard Russo with us in the fall of 2019 when his latest novel, Chances Are, first came out. Hey, stay with us. It's time for another quick break. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. Welcome back to this Memorial Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this hour we are listening back to some of our favorite segments about coming back together. We heard from Billy Baker and the importance of finding a connection with your friends, and we heard from Richard Russo about reflecting on the past through a fictional college reunion. Now, our final segment today is really about a different type of coming together, finding and finally meeting a parent. It's the story of Rachel Twyman and Tito Jackson. You probably know Tito. As a regular on Radio Boston, he's the CEO of Verdant Medical. He's also a former Boston City Councilor who ran for mayor in 2017. During that mayoral campaign, Tito talked a lot about being adopted. He had already done a bit of research into his birth family. And what he found out was troubling. His mother had been sexually assaulted as a young girl and was forced to give up the baby. That was Tito. Now, after the election, Tito decided to take the next step, and in 2018, he and his birth mother, Rachel, finally reunited. They went public about it recently, and in April, the three of us talked about that reunion. We were all remote because of the pandemic. Rachel actually talked to us from her car on a break from work. And Tito began by telling us how his quest first began. And listen, just a quick warning, parts of this conversation may be difficult for survivors of sexual assault and for those who have had painful adoption experiences.
In college, I had a physician who was a pain in my butt at the University of New Hampshire, and he asked me about pre-existing conditions in my family, and I said, listen, man, I'm adopted, so I'm just going to assume that all that stuff in there is stuff that I might have a previous family history. And he said, you know, even though it's a closed adoption state in Massachusetts, you can call the adoption agency and find out what happened, or kind of a narrative. And at that time, there was an organization called, well, it's been taken over by the Home for Little Wanderers now, but I think it was called Boston Children's Services. And I called them up, and they sent me a narrative that was pretty disturbing. And in fact, it came at an intersection in my life where I was part of a program at the University of New Hampshire called the Sexual Harassment and Rape Prevention Program, where I was learning how to be a first responder to people who had been assaulted. And I was going to be speaking at Take Back the Night. And so the letter came to me right the day before I spoke at Take Back the Night. And it said that my mom had been assaulted by two men. And so that was really hard. And so the years pass, and then I finally reach out to the Home for Little Wanderers. You send in a little fee, and then within 2 or 3 months, I got a call from a social worker there that said, "We found your mom. We just spoke to her 5 minutes ago, and her name is Rachel." I'm not gonna give your phone number out, but they gave me her phone number. and that began the connection, because I called her 5 minutes later.
I can't imagine, Rachel, that phone call. Tell us about that moment.
Well, I told the lady it can't be my son because he's dead, because my family told me that he was dead. So I went back in my house and I woke up my other son. I was crying and I was probably the most anxious person in the world. And this was before Tito called me, and I woke up my other son, my oldest son, and I'm like, "Your brother's alive. There's a guy that says he's your brother." And it was just crazy. And then he called me and he explained to me what he had done in his life and how he had got adopted and how he's been searching for me. And I just told him that, well, we need to meet so I can tell him the truth of how he was conceived and brought into this world and what a horrible time and what a horrible life I've had just dealing with that particular part of my life.
Tito, I want to go back to Rachel and talk a little more in a minute, but hearing your birth mother tell this story now in such a brave and straightforward way, what do you find yourself thinking when you hear that out loud?
I just, I think about, when I went in to meet Rachel, I was really selfish. And I was very much thinking about myself, about this piece that was missing in my life and that I wanted to complete myself and kind of square off all of these things. And I was very self-absorbed at that time. And then when I met Rachel, basically instantly my self-absorption went to think about what it would mean for a 12-year-old girl to be raped. And also, most of the interest in Rachel's life was in the book, The Common Ground. Everyone wants to talk about desegregation. Some people call it forced busing. But she was a 12-year-old girl with a baby in her belly who was on a bus that people on the bus were essentially assaulting her, and also people outside of the bus. That's surreal to think about what that must have been like. And so essentially, I was thinking about myself, and when it comes down to it, Rachel had to live that life and deal with all of those things well before I was even brought into this world. So it makes me think about the systems that I worked in as a city councilor and working in the state government, all of those systems, including the Boston Public Schools, where I was chair of the Committee on Education on the Boston City Council, they failed my mom.
Rachel, a version of your story is told in J. Anthony Lucas's Common Ground, A Turbulent Decade in the Lives of Three American Families. As Tito just talked about, the book talks about how you were bused to Charlestown from the South End as part of the desegregation efforts in the 1970s. You've also told us just a horrific part of your story. You said that Tito's conception and birth obviously were traumatic, and that for a while after, you didn't think about the baby you had given birth to because it was too painful. What made you start thinking of that baby again?
In 2010, my middle son got murdered in New Bedford. And it another devastating blow.
Yeah,
unexpected.
So
unexpected. So now I have two sons that have been taken from me. And I have a very, very good friend, Zelta Brooks, who stands by my side and who has always tried to help me get through this. And she said, you know, Rach, maybe it's time to start looking for that baby. And that's when I really consciously started looking for him. Because for a long time, I could not deal with the situation that I was raped.
Rachel, after your middle son was murdered and you decided at a friend's encouragement to go looking for that baby that is Tito, at that point, had you been told that he was dead?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was told that he lived in a different state. He was in Ohio, Detroit. He was a gangster, drug dealer. He's running the streets. He got shot up. I was told all of that. This is by my mother's sister and brother. But the bigger problem is I had no access or way to find Tito. All the avenues that I thought I could possibly go through to find this child were closed doors. So everything was in Tito's hands. So if he didn't find me, I'd still be in the wilderness about this.
So then he finds you. You get the phone call, you wake up your other son, you tell him, you talk with Tito, and you discover that he is a person who has dedicated a chunk of his career to disparities, to righting inequalities, to taking on some of the systemic racism in the community that you experienced. How did it feel to know that that boy who you thought was gone had been out doing that work?
I was so happy. I was so happy. I'm proud of all my children. He just happens to be the one that was in the political limelight, which I had nothing to do with. All I did was bring this young man into the world. So he chose a path, maybe possibly because of his how he saw his life. But I'm just glad that he wanted to give back. And it's a blessing that he's in that limelight, and it helps me get to where I need to be at.
I want to acknowledge Rachel for attempting to find me. And I think it's important that, Rachel, you talk about what happened when you made that attempt at Boston City Hall.
The death of my son really had me distraught. Through those tears, my youngest son told me, he says, Ma, we're going to go to City Hall, see if we can get the birth certificate. So we drive from New Bedford to City Hall. I went down to the birth certificate window, and I finally put 1975, and I put April. And I wrote baby boy Twyman. And I gave the paper to the lady. Me and my son stood there for a long time. And the lady came back to the window and she said, I can't help you. I can't help you because you need a lawyer. I said, what are you talking about? That's my baby. So my youngest son, he just picked me up and took me outside. It was so devastating because why doesn't nobody want to help me find his child? Oh my God. I was just a ball of tears.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
One also just surreal piece about that is that while Rachel was on the second floor at City Hall, I was on the fifth floor because I was a city councilor.
How does that feel, Tito?
Ships passing in the night. We have figured out that I went to school, I went to Sunday school with my brother, that Rachel babysat my chief of staff, Michelle, when she was a kid, because they lived in the same building, and that I was effectively campaigning Tiziana, because I, when I was running for mayor, I gave my mom and my brother's campaign literature and asked them for their vote for the city, for the mayor of the city of Boston. So that means my campaign manager and campaign staff will be very happy to know that I distributed literature to them. And, you know, we have walked, we've literally been in the same place multiple times in our life. And this has been a long journey. It's been circuitous, but when it comes down to it, it has been so worth the journey, because I now have two amazing moms who are both 5'1", and they are giants, and I am literally the luckiest human being on earth to be able to have two moms, and Rachel and my mom Rosa. That might mean I might have been a bad kid. I had to have two, you know, it is so satisfying to be able to connect with my mom and then also my brothers, because they were that missing piece and part of me.
So you have these two now. Your birth mother is a petite powerhouse. Your adoptive mother is a petite powerhouse. I want to ask you about your adoptive parents, where they are in all of this. And if you can tell me how they're feeling about all of this. Did you talk to them? Did you tell them what you were trying to do? Did they support you?
So my dad, Herb Jackson, was a organizer. He fought literally to his death in 2002 to make sure that
that's right.
Yeah, no, but he was, you know, he's a fighter. Women, people of color, and Boston residents got on construction sites. And, you know, to this day, and it's funny because my dad rarely called me my name. He rarely called me Tito. He always called me my son. When I was a younger man, I wanted to go and not be like my dad and do all this. And I'm literally doing everything that my dad was doing. So I'm grateful. And then my mom, Rosa Jackson, lives in Jacksonville. That's I actually hadn't thought about that, but my mom lives in Jacksonville. And so she has been uber supportive to all of her children who were adopted. So that my parents had four kids biologically, and three of us are adopted. And I remind my older siblings that I was chosen, unlike them. They just had them. I mess with them all the time. But when it comes to my mom, she has been like so, so supportive. And in fact, she encouraged me many years ago to go find my mom. She thought it was really important. And she has been with me through every step of this. And just looking forward to having both of my moms in the same place at one time, because that has not happened yet. So I'm really excited for the day that comes.
Rachel, you've told us a story of a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of people who should have cared for you who let you down. And now this son comes back into your life, is ready for a relationship. What does this mean for you now, and what does it mean for your life going forward?
I welcome Tito into my life. I've had a tough life, but it's okay, because these are the benefits of me just plugging away. You know what I'm saying? I have a lot of faith, and I believe in my God. And I just knew that one day this was going to happen. I didn't know it was going to happen like this, and I didn't know he was going to be this big old guy and this public figure. And, you know, I just always wanted him to be healthy and okay. So with that being said, I live my life trying to be an overachiever and do good and be nice to people and try to raise my son so they could grow up and be productive citizens of this world. So if they ever meet this big brother, we all be proud of each other.
I'm proud of you, Madra.
Yeah.
I'm very, very, I'm very proud of you. And I'm proud of your, like, there's so many people who would have given up. And by the way, rightfully so. Like, I'm not even, you know, there's so many folks who along the way, but your strength and your courage and your persistence and your unwillingness to give up is.
I just always wanted to be, I didn't care what else happened in my life. I just wanted to be the best mother I could be. And I wanted my children to love me. That's all I wanted. And they love me. And I just want Tito to love me.
Tito, can I ask you a couple of fun questions?
Yep.
And Rachel, hopefully you'll enjoy these too. Tito, first, why Madre?
You know, that's what she told me to call her. So she's my mama and she told me to call her Madre. So that's what I,
well, I'll have to answer that question. Answer that question for you. So I live in New Bedford. I'm the neighborhood mom. I only have sons. So most of the people that are around me are male. I adopted this young man named Angel. He's Spanish, and he started calling me Madre. Because I take care of everybody's children. When they don't want to take care of them, that's me. That's what I do.
All right, Tito, last question. Do you have her eyes or her nose or her smile? Or?
I have her eyes. I have her nose. I'm a little bit taller than her. give or take a foot and some change. But no, definitely, I definitely favor my mom. I look like my brothers. I'm a little bit taller than them too, which is it's helpful because I get to change the light bulbs in her house. My brother Steven and Michael a little bit smaller than me, but yeah, this is all nature nurture stuff. My adoptive mom Rosa is essentially the same type of person that Madre is in terms of the community. She had a daycare for 25 years. She had her 7 kids, and so I just am really, really lucky, and I thank God every day for this miracle that has been brought into my life with being able to meet my birth mom and to build a relationship with her. And it means a lot to me that she's proud of me. And it has been a very positive experience between us, but I definitely have to acknowledge the folks who this may be too much for them. And we need to honor and hold space for people who are in that spot.
It's hard. I've been through so much. All by myself. I thank God for just keeping me together and holding me so I can be this woman that I am.
And Madre, I love you.
I love you too.
I do.
That was former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson, CEO of Verdant Medical, and his birth mother, Rachel Twyman, telling us the story of their reunion back in April. And while we're out of time for today's show, on our website, you can find a follow-up segment that we did with Tito and his adoptive mother, Rosa. It's also a beautiful reflection, and I hope you'll check it out. That's our show for this Memorial Day, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering, and from all of us here at Radio Boston, we hope you enjoyed your Memorial Day, reuniting with family and friends. And we also hope you'll rejoin us here again tomorrow.